White Network presents. The International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to the 57th episode of the International Jew on this 25th of April, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And it's nice to have you back again, Hadding. We missed you last week. Okay, and of course, if you want to tell people, the listeners, why you weren't here.
Oh, now the teacher's making me explain. I just lost track of what day it was. I think I was just kind of wrapped up in things after the Zimmerman verdict. And yeah. I was sure it couldn't be Thursday yet. I thought it might be Wednesday, but oh well.
Well, I was able to carry on, although it is better to have both of us, so I'm glad you're back this week. And our chapter tonight is, reasonably good length, so we want to get right on it. And it, well, you go ahead and announce. It's chapter 52, right, Hattie?
Yes. How the Jews Use Power by an Eyewitness. The Jewish question continues to mount the scale of public attention, attracting ever a higher type of mind to the discussion of its significance. Ever a higher type of mind.
Yeah, that higher type of mind, that's really interesting, isn't it?
When the Dearborn Independent first began to print some of the results of its research into the question, the initial response was largely from those who disliked the Jew because he was a Jew. This class expected to find, in the Dearborn Independent, a spokesman for all their coarse humor and abuse. The method that was followed by this paper, however, was not abusive enough, nor bitter enough, to satisfy Jew baiters and Jew haters.
Like us!
And gradually, a new response from another class began to be heard, which by this time has attained massive proportions. The better class of people, seeing that racial and religious prejudice had no part in the work, began to consider the question with relation to our American life and the future of this nation as a Christian people. Upon this ascent of the discussion to its proper plane, the better periodicals began to give thoughtful attention to the matter. These publications have been referred to in previous articles. There is to be added to the list the Century Magazine for September, which contains an article by Herbert Adams Gibbons, which clearly intends to be fair, and is certainly able, in spite of a difference of opinion that might exist with regard to some of the author's conclusions. Mr. Gibbons states some matters more plainly than they have been stated outside the pages of the Dearborn Independent. And some matters he states just as plainly, and he will be justified by the unprejudiced reader. One of the most notable studies of the Jewish question has come out of the University of the South at Suwanee, Tennessee. It is entitled Zionism and the Jewish Problem, the author being the Reverend Dr. John P. Peters, formerly Canaan Residentiary of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, Morningside Heights, New York. Also, Rector Emeritus of St. Michael's Church, New York, and a professor of New Testament Languages and Literature in the University of the South. The article has been reprinted from the Sewanee Review and makes a brochure of 29 pages. Dr. Peters begins with an historical sketch of the development of the two lines of thought among the Jews. The nationalistic, which made for exclusiveness, and the religious, which made for inclusiveness. And he describes the domination of the latter by the former with the coming of modern Zionism, which he finds to be racial and not religious. He says, the dominant control of the Zionist party is at present in the hands of those who are not religious but merely racial Jews. He believes that the development of race consciousness along these lines must be inevitably, in the end, to make the Jews bad citizens of the United States or of any other country, and to keep alive and increase the hostility to the Jews. They're saying there that their Jewish ethnocentrism is and exclusivity is bound to generate hostility wherever they go.
Yeah, that's what he's saying.
This monograph by Dr. Peters will repay study. By permission, the Dearborn Independent reprints the article from page 20 to the end. They got permission. This portion being selected because it deals with Dr. Peters' testimony as an eyewitness of certain conditions in Palestine. The italics are ours, there being none in the university reprint. Now, you won't be able to hear italics.
No.
Clearly.
Well, we can hear them through the way you read it.
All right. Okay, here we go with Professor Peters. The experiment of the Zionist homeland is now being tried. It is too early to determine fully how it will work, but it is at least of interest to consider its manifestations so far. My earliest contact with Zionism and Zionistic influences in Palestine dates from 1902. When I first visited Palestine in 1890, the Jews in Jerusalem were almost exclusively of old Oriental Sephardic families. Jerusalem was then still the old Jerusalem within the walls. There were no houses without. Jewish colonization, economic and philanthropic in character, had just then begun on the Sharon Plain. But what little there was on the way of colonization was a feeble, unsuccessful exotic, an attempt to replace the persecuted Jews of Russia on the land where, however, the Jew, unused to manual and especially farm labor, sat under an umbrella to protect himself from the sun and engaged native Syrians to do the work. That's in 1890 he's talking
about.
Yeah,
and now these are the Sephardic Jews, the ones that have been living there for many years, right?
And this location that he mentions, the Sharon Plain or Sharon Plain, that's the area of Jaffa where Tel Aviv was founded. There's an article on the BBC website currently that refers to the fact that Germans settled in Palestine before Zionist Jews went there to resettle. The Germans actually started reforestation and other things that made Palestine more habitable. And it was a few years after they had started doing that, before the Jews flocked in,
sounds right. Huh.
It started to trickle in. And he says on the Sharon Plain, well, that's where one of the German colonies was called Sarona. That's maybe the most important German colony there. Sarona started producing oranges shortly after it was founded. And by 1893, it was famous for oranges. So they founded the Sarona 1871, I believe. And by 1893, it was famous all over the world for oranges, for Jaffa oranges. because Sarona was near Jaffa, and then Tel Aviv was founded next to Sarona.
You know, why did the Germans do that? These were just individual Germans who were looking for opportunities,
I think they were some kind of good works. Well, they called them Templars.
Okay.
I think they were some kind of Protestant fanatics that wanted to live in the Holy Land, something like that.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's very interesting. And they actually do the work. Well, German farmers are famous wherever they go. They are the best people to work the land and build up agriculture and so on, and beautiful farms.
Yeah. Those Germans who actually did the pioneering for these Jews are not mentioned in this article here. Probably weren't mentioned by Peters. All right. Back to the narrative here. Jewish colonization, economic and philanthropic in character, had just then begun on the Sharon Plain, 1890. But what little there was in the way of colonization was a feeble, unsuccessful exotic. An attempt to replace the persecuted Jews of Russia on the land where, however, the Jew, unused to manual and especially farm labor, sat under an umbrella to protect himself from the sun and engaged native Syrians to do the work. On my next visit, in 1902, more colonies had been planted, and a serious effort was being made to turn the Jewish colonists into farmers. The majority of the Jews who had come to Palestine, however, were settled about Jerusalem. And the new Jerusalem, without the walls, was larger, in space at least, than the old Jerusalem within. The Alliance Israélite had developed their splendid schools to teach agriculture, and manual and industrial arts. Basically a trade school. I was urgently solicited by the management to visit and inspect these schools. Here I found Jew, Muslim, and Christian working side by side without prejudice. This was, in my judgment, the best work of any sort being done in Palestine, for two reasons. First, these schools were teaching the dignity and the worth of manual labor, which the Oriental, of all sorts, had theretofore despised. Oriental means Semites, basically. Regarding it as unworthy of any man of intelligence or capacity. Secondly, because they brought Muslim, Christian, and Jew together on a plane of common work and common worth, the most valuable agent for the breaking down of those ancient prejudices, religious, racial, and social, which have been the curse and bane of the land.
He's somebody who was a liberal or would be turned into a liberal, and their whole idea is that we can all work together and get along together if we just lay down our prejudices, right?
Yeah.
Well, we've tried that a lot. I mean, I respect the ideas, but we've tried it a lot, and there's some things that don't quite add up in that kind of attitude. But
well, the paradox is that if you really believe in your religion, you should be fanatical about it. You know, it's hard to reconcile moderation in religion with really believing in it. So it's a little weird that this comes from, some doctor of divinity.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But that's the kind of doctors of divinity we've had then and still now, where they're not fanatical at all about it. They're more fanatical. They're more interested in what they call peace on earth and, you know, brotherhood and things like that than about their religious beliefs. Anyway.
I was asked to put this down in writing because I was told great pressure was being exerted, I regret to say, especially from America, to prevent the management from continuing this particular work of teaching Jew, Christian, and Muslim on the same plane. the demand being that the Jew should not be brought into such contact with the Muslim and the Christian, and that he alone should be trained, that he might not be infected, as it were, by the others, and that they might not be prepared to compete with him for possession of the land.
So he's talking about the Jews in America who were not happy with this and were writing to prevent this kind of work of teaching these three religious groups of people to in the same place, the same things and so on, to get along together.
Yeah, you know, I've heard the observation from time to time about the state of Israel and American Zionist Jews in recent times, that the American Zionist Jews are always demanding the extreme position, more extreme than the Jews that actually live over there.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Shah of Iran made a comment like that too when he's interviewed by Mike Wallace.
Well, that's true. I think that's pretty well understood that that the Jews, they always say that the Jews of Palestine, from going way back, were able to live in peace with the Christians and Muslims, but it's these new Zionist Jews that didn't want any part of that.
Well, there weren't very many Jews there until after the
Zionists. That's right. They didn't have any kind of power. Anyway.
This spirit I met in a more thoroughly organized and offensive form on my latest visit in 1919 and 1920. I found immense progress in the development of agricultural colonies. There was still difficulty in persuading the Jew, except only the African or Arabian Jew, to do the actual work of the colony. But colonies were prospering, and fruit culture, vine culture, and especially the manufacture of wine and liquors on a grand and most scientific scale had progressed wonderfully, mostly probably done by Germans, actually.
Jeez, the damn Germans. They're always helping these people who, in the end, you know, attack them and do them in.
As a matter of fact, this article on the BBC website about the Templars says that it was the Germans that made Jaffa oranges famous, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In general, the land occupied, as written by a Jew, in general, the land occupied by those colonies was not in a proper sense ancient Jewish land. They were on the Sharon and Esdraelon plains and in the extreme upper end of the Jordan Valley. But those regions were being enriched and the country at large benefited by the colonists. Now, this is correct that the state of Israel today also includes a lot of area, or it came to include a lot of area that was not ancestral Jewish land. If you look at ancient Judea, it's just a little patch of land on the shore of the Dead Sea. That's all.
Okay. And now they think they're what?
Well, they didn't have any coastline.
Hmm.
On the Mediterranean. That's where the Philistines lived.
They were just these scabby people who somehow, you know, have invented this history. That's what I think. I think they invented this history, stole stuff from all over the place, and
well,
have managed to convince people.
I don't want to get into that because you have friends that will be offended. But, Jewish history is largely mythology.
Well, I think it is. Even
right.
If it does offend.
And Voltaire could tell you that, too. It's like, well, did you ever read Voltaire's account of the history of the Jews?
No.
Yeah, well, he...
I know he was supposed to be anti-Semite, but I...
Well, Voltaire was very critical of the Jews' alleged history in the Old Testament. He discusses the miracles in the Old Testament with great irony. You know, he says, you know, of course we are obliged to believe these things, you know. And he talks about the fact that when they crossed a particular river, that the Lord parted it for them And Voltaire says, well, of course, the river is only 3 feet deep, but when you are the chosen people, you know, whatever.
Yeah. So, yeah. No, I mean, you know, it's all, yeah, I don't know. It's just like with all these things people believe. They believe these stories because they're attractive to them, I guess. They like to believe stuff. Oh, well, let's go on. You're right. We shouldn't get into this.
All right. So these Jews are in the Sharon and Esdraelon plains. But those regions were being enriched, and the country at large benefited by the colonists. Again, he's not distinguishing the Germans. He's not even mentioning that there were Germans there. The great bulk of the Jews were still gathered in Jerusalem as heretofore, and there were, on one hand, the intellectuals, and on the other, the parasitic or pauperized Jew. What would ordinarily be regarded as the very best and the very worst of the Jews. Life in the colonies was often very sweet and very lovely, a wholesome, normal family life, and an exhibition in peace and prosperity of what religious Judaism, at its best, may be.
You see how they try to, you know, just paint up the Jews as well as they possibly can. Well, I'm sure they weren't more sweet and lovely than the other non-Jewish people, but, you know, there's just,
you know,
effort.
I have on my blog excerpts from a travel diary called The People in the Land by a Christian minister named William Thompson. And he gives a much less rosy account of the Jews. I mean, he's writing in 1881, which is, you know, it's like a few years earlier.
Yeah, right.
But he says that the Jews in Jerusalem were a bunch of sourpusses. I don't think he mentions seeing Jews anywhere else except at Jerusalem. Okay, continuing with Peter's. In Jerusalem, one found the extremes of intensely narrow and bitter orthodoxy and unbelief with extreme Bolshevik radicalism.
Here, too. There you go. So he's saying that these Jews in Jerusalem were not at all like the ones elsewhere. Right? I mean, like the ones in the colonies who were sweet and lovely.
Yeah, in the smaller towns in Palestine.
Yeah, okay.
Here, too, aggressive Zionism manifested itself in an attitude of bumptiousness and aggressiveness. The country was for the Jew. It belonged to him, and he would shortly take possession. One was made to feel that one's presence in the land was objected to. The Hebrew press contained angry diatribes against the existence of Christian schools and missions. The attitude was taken by these Zionists, at first alarmed, then aroused and irritated enormously the native population, both Christian and Muslim, making the Jew an object of dread and hatred as he had never been before. I had opportunities to talk on intimate and friendly terms with leaders in all camps, albeit I was unable, through language difficulties, to communicate with the rank and file as freely as I should like to have done. I myself felt the annoyance and, in some places, the danger of the animosity aroused. Under government order, I was not permitted to visit certain sections of the country, on account of the raids or uprisings of the Arabs, partly due to the animosity aroused by their apprehension of the Jewish invasion, and partly due to banditry, which took advantage of that as an occasion. In other parts, it was difficult to travel because any stranger, unless he could prove the contrary, was suspected of being an agent of the Zionists, spying out the land for possession by the Jews. It was difficult to obtain lodgings or food, and there were sometimes unpleasantly hostile demonstrations on account of these suspicions. Everywhere it was believed that the Jew, by unfair means, was seeking to oust the true owners and to take possession of their land. This is, what, 1921?
What he's talking about right now? He was, no, he was there in 1919, 1920. So I guess so. Yeah, he's talking about his current trip, I guess. And,
suspicion was largely correct.
Yeah, and the suspicion, it was. And it was by the Arabs. He's talking about the Arabs who were so worried and weren't very friendly to strangers who were, you know, white, European, because they thought they were maybe Zionists.
In Jerusalem, it was asserted that the Zionist funds, or the Jewish funds, which the Zionists could influence or control, were used to subsidize Jewish artisans or merchants to underbid Christians and Muslims, and thus oust them by unfair competition, and that similar means were being used to acquire lands or titles to lands. It was even believed by many that the English authorities were unduly favoring and helping the Jews in these endeavors, as is shown by a letter from a Christian in Jaffa published in the Atlantic Monthly. Here's the Christian speaking. "We are already feeling that we have a government within a government. British officers cannot stand on the right side because they are afraid of being removed from their posts or ticked off. From time immemorial, the Jews the world over have contributed for the help of pious Jews in Jerusalem and the other sacred cities, Hebron, Tiberias, and Safed, the so-called Halucha or Dole, in return for which the Jews in those cities were to win merit for themselves and those who contributed to their support by study of the law, prayer, and pious observances. St. Paul carried over the same practice into the Christian church, causing alms to be collected in the different congregations to be transferred to Jerusalem for the benefit and support of the Christians living there. To this day, annual collections are taken in the Roman Catholic churches throughout the world, which go to the Franciscans for the same use in Jerusalem. The Greeks and Armenians have like customs." I guess he means the Greek and Armenian churches. "Mm-hmm. In the past, there had been no prejudice with regard to these doles. But now it was claimed the Zionist committees were using the monies thus collected or contributed to organize and help their people in a systematized attempt to gain the upper hand in the land. Perhaps the attitude of the extremists who possessed the dominating power in the community can best be shown by the utterances of one of their own organs, written in Hebrew. It should be stated that the English edition of this journal was, as a rule, quite different in its contents from the Hebrew edition. One article entitled Malignant Leprosy is a denunciation of parents who allow their children to go to any school except those under the control of Jews and conforming to the demands of the local Zionist committee. Parents are notified that a list has been made by the Zionist committee of all children who are attending foreign schools, even though they are not subjected to any religious teaching, and it is demanded that they shall be withdrawn from those schools and placed in schools where they shall be taught the Hebrew language, customs, and traditions, and kept separate from contamination by the Gentile with his different ways and customs. Those teaching in foreign schools or schools not complying with the conditions laid down by this committee are ordered to withdraw from their positions. The malignant leprosy is the contamination by the outside world which results from education with the Gentiles. It is admitted in this article, in answer to protests, that the opportunities in some of the non-Jewish schools are better than in the Jewish schools. For example, in the teaching of foreign languages, so important for conducting business or securing employment, that there is greater diligence in instructing, and better hours and better care of pupils. Nevertheless, parents are informed that they must sacrifice, for the sake of their race, those chances for their children, doing their best meanwhile to raise their own schools to the higher level. Those who are failing to live up to these ideals are designated as traitors and by other opprobrious names. And the article ends with this threat of persecution to any who do not obey the orders of the Zionist committee thus conveyed.
Let him know, at least, that it is forbidden him to be called by the name of Jew, and there is to him no portion or inheritance with his brethren. And if, after a time, they will not try to reform, let them know that we will fight against them by all lawful means at our disposal. Upon a monument of shame we will put their names for a reproach and a blaming forever, and unto the last generation shall their deeds be written. If they are supported, their support will cease, and if they are merchants, with a finger men will shoot at them, and if they are rabbis, they will be moved far from their office, and with the ban shall they be persecuted, and all the people of the world shall know that there is no mercy in judgment.
That's probably a very serious thing, actually, that shooting with the finger, most likely it means a boycott, and those Jews, those dissident Jews who are trying to make their living as merchants will find themselves unable to make any living among Jews anyway. This was followed about a month later by a second article, also in Hebrew, entitled Fight and Win, which announced that the threatened persecution would now be carried out.
The names of the traitorous parents and of the boys and girls who have not taken notice of the warnings ought to be published at once and without delay, in the papers and on public notices, placarded at the entrance of every street. The list of these names should be sent to the heads of every institution and to the rulers of the synagogues, to hospitals, and to those who arrange and solemnize marriages, and to the directors of the American Jewish Relief Fund, and so on. It should be the title of Black List and Traitors to Their People. An order should go forth to all, and if one of these men has a son, he shall not be circumcised. In case of death, the body is not to be buried among Israelites. Religious marriages will not be sanctioned. Jewish doctors will not visit their sick. Relief will not be given to them when they are in need, if they are on the list of the American Relief Fund. In short, we must hunt them down until they are annihilated. Men will cry to them, out of the way, unclean, unclean. Because these people will be considered as malicious renegades, there can be no connecting link between them and us. Again, the society of young men and girls of Jerusalem must accept it as a principle to expel from their societies all those who visit these schools, to point the finger of scorn at them, and to make them see that they are put out of the camp. These traitor scholars, boys and girls, must understand themselves that they are sinners and transgressors who are isolated, driven from all society, separated from the Jewish community, after they have once despised Israel and its holiness. And it will be interdicted to all sons of Israel to come near them. War against the traitors among our people. War by all means legal. War without pity or mercy. That the traitors may know that they must not trifle with the sentiment of a people. Fight and win!
Well, there's some things to be said about that, but we don't might not have time, so we'll just go ahead with the reading.
Yeah, that's totally wacky there.
Well, it is, but you know, there's a lot of in white nationalism where they're saying if we were like this, we'd be better off, but maybe not quite the way, not the way they are, because that is wacky. Because well, they're just talking about kids going to school. That's all they're talking about.
Right. Okay, the Zionist committee, of whom one was an American, followed this by a printed announcement that the time of grace had passed, and that forthwith the names of those who were still refractory would be posted publicly on street corners, and the boycott begin. Miss Landau, a devout Jewess, the head of the best and highest Jewish school for girls in the city, the Eva Rothschild School, one of those, however, whose pupils and teachers were threatened under these rulings because they would not follow the dictates of the Zionist committee, appealed to the civil authorities. The committee was hailed into court and the threatened boycott enjoined. With such an attitude on the part of Zionist leaders in Jerusalem, it might be expected that violence would ensue. Easter is a time of great excitement and unrest in Jerusalem for Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike. For with Easter coincide the Jewish Passover and the Muslim pilgrim feast of Nebi Musa, when Muslims gather from all over Palestine to hear sermons in the Haram Esh-Sharif, and then march to the so-called Tomb of Moses near the Dead Sea. The religious excitement of that season, which vents itself in curses of each against the others, is always likely to produce physical outbursts if the cursors come into contact with each other. The Turks wisely segregated, at that time, each religion into its own quarter. This, in spite of warnings and requests from the Muslim religious leaders, the English have failed to do, either through ultra-confidence in the Pax Anglicana, or because of objections from Jewish representatives against such segregation as applied to them. For days beforehand, hotheads among the Jews and Muslims were inciting to riot, and in their quarter, Jewish-trained bands were preparing for the conflict, a preparation of which Muslims, from long wont, probably had no need. On Easter morning, 1920, the fanatical Muslims of Hebron arrived at the Jaffa Gate with their sacred banner, singing their songs of religious intolerance. There, numerous Jews were waiting to greet them. The English Tommies with their officers were all in church. Whose insults were the worst and who struck the first blow is not clear. Battle was speedily enjoined. The Jews were better armed, with guns against the Muslim knives. But the Muslims were the better fighters. The city within the walls was speedily in their hands. The Jews living there were the old-time Sephardic families, dwelling close-packed in miserable slums, with no sympathy with Zionism, peaceful and quite unprepared. Muslim fury vented itself on these poor wretches. Outside the walls, the Jews were in the vast majority. All told, by official count, there were at that time 28,000 Jews, 16,000 Christians, and 14,500 Muslims in Jerusalem. What the Muslims did within the walls, the Jew endeavored to do outside the walls. Before my eyes, an Arab camp just below the great Jewish quarters was set upon, burned, and plundered, the poor inhabitants fleeing for their lives while guns popped from the Jewish quarter. Two men were killed there. When the troops reached the scene, the great bulk of rioters, whom they rounded up, were Jews. The subsequent court proceedings also seemed to place the chief responsibility for the outbreak on them. The major sentences were equally divided between Jews and Muslims, But of the criminals who received lighter sentences, the majority were Jews. For a week we lived in a state of siege, not allowed to pass in or out of the city gates, or to show ourselves on roof or balcony after sundown. And for months there were guards at every turn, assemblies were prohibited, and there was continual danger of a new outbreak. The appointment of Sir Herbert Samuel, a Jew, as governor of the new protectorate under the Zionist mandate, greatly increased the excitement. In Muslim towns like Nablus, it was openly said in my presence that no Jew might enter the place and live. The Christians, who had taken no part in the riots, were nevertheless, to a man, in sympathy with the Muslims, and one saw the curious spectacle of cross and crescent making common cause. It was prophesied that should Sir Herbert Samuel come as governor, he would never enter Jerusalem alive. In point of fact, he landed at Jaffa and came up to Jerusalem under strong guard, with machine guns before and behind, and the following week made a visit to Nablus and Haifa in the same manner. That was the situation when I left Palestine. Sir Herbert had at that time just issued his declaration and his interpretation of the mandate. English officers and officials, almost to a man, were against the Zionist mandate, and their utterances in many cases were extraordinarily frank. Some of the most prominent and best trained sought transfers to other posts because of their feelings on the matter, and some resigned. It has, since that time, been extremely difficult to obtain reliable information of prevailing conditions. It would seem, however, from all the information I have been able to gather, that Sir Herbert, who is, I believe, not himself a Zionist, has acted with singular tact and discretion. He has shown great fairness and indicated his intention to govern with impartiality, granting no special favors to any, nor allowing outside committees or local organizations to dictate or assume to dictate unfair policies. When I left Palestine, Jews were leaving in considerable numbers, especially those claiming American citizenship, so that the outgo was larger than the income. Since then, if I may judge by reports, Jews have been coming in chiefly from Eastern European countries, some parasitic and objectionable, others of a higher type. Some of the latter, graduates of universities, both men and women, may be seen engaged in hard manual labor, I am told, building roads and the like, not despising to do such work in order to secure their Palestinian home and fulfill their aspirations.
Well, notice that he says some of these Eastern European Jews of the higher type are engaged in manual labor. He is told. He hasn't seen it. He's told. So, you know, some of that lot may have been more propaganda than reality as to how hard these people wanted to work, these Jews coming in. But I know some of them did. They came with that intention that they were going to, you know, build and then they started the communal system and so on. But anyway.
It is too soon to judge the future of the Zionist experiment in Palestine. If the English authorities will give fair play to all, and if the Jews will pursue the old policy of the Alliance Israelite and its schools of seeking to benefit all dwellers of the land alike, to break down, not build up, religious, racial, and social prejudices, then the Jew may perhaps overcome the present prejudice against him, and his invasion of Palestine may prove to be a blessing both to himself and to the land. The methods of those in control of the Zionist movement in Palestine, while I was there, were, however, aimed in the opposite direction, and tended to make the Jew an object of hatred and violence wherever the opportunity for violence offered.
This has been illustrated again by the recent bloody riot in Jaffa, which compelled the expedition of a British warship to that port. And the order issued holding up all immigration shows that not Jaffa only, but the whole country is unsafe. The Jews in Palestine are now protected only by force of British arms. Were the British troops withdrawn, the Jews would be exterminated by the angry natives, of whom the Muslims alone outnumber them in the ratio of more than 10 to 1, and with such action the neighboring countries would sympathize, yielding ready assistance if any were required. Mesopotamia and Egypt are seething with disaffection against British rule and racial religious ferment. And Palestine is to them, and to the Arabs of Arabia, a holy land included in the heritage of Islam. Muslim India, that would be Pakistan today, also feels this keenly. And the British have been obliged to withdraw Muslim Indian troops from Palestine because they will not fight fellow Muslims. Okay, I just want to point out that even today, the Zionist project, the State of Israel, is dependent on the protection of a foreign power, dependent on the protection of the United States. Jews like to boast about how their petit pays de merde, as the French foreign minister once called it, how their little country is self-sufficient and able to defend itself, but that's far from true, since the gigantic multi-trillion dollar wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the smaller wars in other places in recent years have been entirely about protecting the State of Israel. I mean Middle East and Arab wars by the United States. In this country, this is Peters speaking, and now he's talking about the United States. In this country, the Jewish problem which we have hitherto had to face is not a result of religious antipathy. Religiously, politically, and economically, the Jew has the same opportunity as everyone else in the United States. The Jewish problem here has been merely a matter of social prejudice, resulting from the extremely difficult task of amalgamating with great rapidity an enormous population, alien in race, culture, custom, and habit. In 1880, there were, according to Jewish statistics, 250,000 Jews in this country, the United States. The Jews now claim 3,500,000, for the most part, an undistributed mass huddled together in a few of the great cities, one-third of them in New York. Coming in such great numbers in so short a time, and herding together thus, intentionally or unintentionally, they help one another to resist the process of Americanization. This enormously increases the incidence of social prejudice. Those who have no conscious prejudice either of religion or of race are in danger of imbibing or developing such prejudice as a method of protection of their institutions, their traditions, and their habits. The Zionist movement, with its intentional development of race consciousness and race peculiarity on the part of the Jew, is an additional obstacle against the efforts of those Jews and those Christians who are seeking to break down prejudice and to bring Jew and Christian together within a common recognition of the golden rule, that each should treat the other as he, in like instance, would wish to be treated by him. One of the greatest of English Jews, honored and respected by Jew and Christian alike for his learning, his philanthropy, and his godly piety, says of this racial political Zionism that it has broken his heart, and set the clock backward for his people 100 years. The Christian lover of his country and his fellow men may well express a similar feeling on his side.
Okay, we had a technical problem in this show. We were interrupted a couple of times, and I've just finished it out there. So for Carolyn Yeager and myself, I want to thank you for listening and join us again next week on the International Jew Study Hour. Thank you.
And, oh.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.